We are in the third week of our series going through the book of Genesis. If you have a bulletin with you, quick review for you. Maybe you weren't here the last couple of weeks, maybe you were, and it's already gone. We start out the first week doing an overview of the entire book of Genesis, giving more attention to the first portion of the book. And in chapters 1 and 2, God makes a good world for humanity. Once again, our Hebrew quiz. What is the Hebrew word that we translate as good? You guys are getting so very good at that. Tov, translated usually as good, can just as easily be translated as beautiful, functional. God created a world that was good, beautiful, was functioning just the way he wanted it to function. Then chapters 3 through 11, human sin and the ruin of God's world. And we had to wrestle with the fact that chapters 3 through 11 are our story as well. Because of our choices to go our own way, we have contributed to the destruction of a world that was created, Tov. Last week, we moved into the next portion of the book of Genesis. God initiates his plan to rescue humanity. And we looked at the story and the call of Abraham and the beginning of God's Tov restoration project. This week, we're in the 32nd chapter of Genesis, where we get to meet Abraham's grandson, Jacob. If you have a Bible with you, I'd encourage you to open up to the 32nd chapter of Genesis. Don't have a Bible? They're under most of the chairs. I'm going to read through this passage, then we're going to go back into the passage and kind of unpack it, because you will discover that this particular passage we're going to look at can best be described as weird. I think that's the biblical term. Picking up in verse 22 of chapter 32, that night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with human beings and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him. So Jacob called that place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Like I said, a little weird. So let's go back and kind of unpack this a little bit, because there's an awful lot in these 10 or 11 verses. It starts out and it says this in verse 22, that night Jacob. Okay, we should probably take a moment to unpack who Jacob is. Jacob is, and I'm trying to think of the best way to put this, Jacob is a jerk. Okay, maybe you don't like the word jerk. Scoundrel, scallywag, whatever. Jacob is not the kind of guy you'd want to spend time with. If you know his story at all, you go, yeah, Jacob's kind of a punk. He is the grandson of Abraham, the son of Isaac, and the twin brother of Esau. As the story goes, as they were being born, Esau was born first, but Jacob grabbed a hold of his brother's ankle as they came out. Jacob, the name means ankle grabber. It does. It could just as easily be translated as backstabber. You'll see that come to play. Because a little bit later in the story, Jacob takes advantage of his brother Esau and basically swindles his brother out of his birthright. Then he deceives his dying blind father in order to obtain the blessing that belonged rightfully to Esau, but he deceived his father. Then Esau is hopping mad at him, and you don't blame him. In fact, at this point in the story, if you're reading through the full story of Jacob, you're rooting for Esau. You really are. And then Jacob finds out that Esau wants to kill him. Well, duh. And he runs away, and he ends up out by himself in the desert, and there has a dream or a vision of a ladder. This is where we get Jacob's ladder. A ladder or stairway coming down from heaven. There are angels going up and down the ladder, stairway. And in the midst of all this, God promises Jacob that he will remain with Jacob and that he will deliver Jacob back to his homeland. And at this point in the story, we are all really, really encouraged, because if God's going to stay with Jacob, that's good news for all imperfect people. If God can be with Jacob, then he can be with me. If there's hope for this guy, there's certainly hope for me. And so Jacob's life continues, and through just very, very self-centered means, he obtains all manners of wealth. And by the time we make it up to the 32nd chapter, Jacob is making his way back home, and he's about to meet up with his brother again. If there was a soundtrack to the life of Jacob, the primary song up to this point would be Frank Sinatra's "I Did It My Way." This is the story of Jacob. It's all about me and what I can get by any means necessary. This is Jacob. So it says, That night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. Again, really strange. One commentator said, "The brief account of the fight is tantalizingly obscure." I just love that description. The brief account of this fight, of this wrestling match, is tantalizingly obscure. Because you read it and you got to ask a lot of questions. What's going on here? For starters, the river's name is the Jabbok. Hebrew, the Jabbok means wrestle. It's the same Hebrew root word that we get the name Jacob. So to say that Jacob wrestled at the river Jabbok is to say wrestle man wrestled at Wrestle River. I can't make this stuff up. If Jacob would have taken the time to realize, "Wait, I'm at the Jabbok. My name is Jacob," he should not have been surprised that WrestleMania broke out that night. In addition to that, it says that he sends people kind of ahead, and he is now by himself. And you got to wonder why. Why is Jacob choosing in this moment to be alone? Remember, he's about ready to meet his brother Esau. And if you go back earlier in chapter 32, you find Jacob praying to God. And this is essentially what he says. He says, "God, save me. I am so afraid." I mean, I get it. He's about ready to meet up with the brother that he swindled, took advantage of. And he's about ready to meet up with him. And he has come to a place in his life where he goes, "God, save me. I am so afraid." And you wonder if he's having second thoughts. Maybe it's like, "Okay, you guys go ahead, I'm out of here." Could be. It doesn't really say. It could be that he's just so overwhelmed by all of it that he just needs a moment alone. But the key word there is alone, and you're going to want to take note of that word alone, because we're going to come back to it in a few moments. And then it says that while he was alone, a man wrestled with him. Okay, who's the man? Who's the man? This has been actually something that has been debated for over 3,000 years. Some people say that the man is an angel, a messenger of God. He's wrestling with an angel. Other people will argue that he's wrestling with Jesus, kind of pre-Christmas Jesus, God in the flesh. Some people argue that he is wrestling with a Canaanite river god. I'm not making this up. Some people argue that. Here is one of those examples where reading the story in English does not help us much. Because when we read the story in English, we lose the word El. Because as you read these 11 verses, the word El comes up, E-L, and it is one of the names given to God. To call God El is to call God the powerful one, the mighty one. It's also where we get these words like El Shaddai or Elohim, the God that is the creator, the God that is the all-sufficient, almighty one. Now, when Jacob finds himself wrestling with this man, he doesn't know who it is. He just got jumped. Later in the story, Jacob realizes that he has indeed been wrestling with God. He acknowledges that toward the end of the story. Which also brings us to the thing, well, wait a second. How can an individual wrestle with God and live? Granted, God could just go, gone. He's dead. But this doesn't happen here. So how could this be? Any one of us that have had kids wrestled with our children. This is what we do as parents. You know, we'll get on the floor, we'll wrestle with our kids. In that moment, we have the physical ability to literally crush our children. I'm not recommending this, but we do have the. We could, if we wanted to, we could kill our children. I know sometimes you say you want to do that. I don't recommend it, but you could. When you had small children, you could physically do that. But you withhold some of your power so that your children are not permanently damaged. It's essentially what's happening here. God withholding the full extent of his power so that Jacob isn't vaporized. Some people, though, say, wait a second. Maybe it didn't actually happen. This is more of a metaphor, a vision. Well, a fine argument until you get to the point where he realizes that Jacob is physically damaged for the remainder of his days. Guess what? You are not physically damaged for the remainder of your days by a vision. Jacob walked with a limp the remainder of his days as a result of this encounter. We pick up the story, though. It continues, and it says in verse 25, when the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. We need to remember that Jacob often took advantage of other people when they were most vulnerable, and now we see God touching him where he is most vulnerable. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Look at the backstory again. Jacob is all about getting a blessing. This is really, really important to him. Verse 27, the man asked, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. This is huge. The fact that Jacob in this moment says that my name is Jacob is tremendously significant. I love what Frederick Holmgren says. He says, remember, when Jacob demands a blessing from the stranger, he asks Jacob's name. This is not a chance question. It was intended to remind Jacob of another time when Isaac, his father, asked his name. Remember, he was going to Isaac for a blessing. And Isaac asked him what his name was. And Jacob, the deceiver, answered, Esau. Now, before God, he admits who he really is, all his sins, all his arrogance, all his deception, and it shows that he is repenting, making a decision to turn away from his deceptive ways. When he says, my name is Jacob, he's owning who he is. He's going, I am the one that has deceived. I am the one that has cheated. I am the one that has taken advantage. I am Jacob. The man said in verse 28, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Your name is no longer Jacob. Your name is Israel. Pastor Andy McQuinty writes this. He says, Israel is translated as one who prevails with God, but it literally means just the opposite. God who prevails with man. God didn't struggle. Jacob didn't struggle with God and won. God struggled with Jacob and won. So what does Israel mean? It truly has a double meaning. God is continually bringing his people to a place of surrender. But in that surrender, they are victorious. In losing, we win. Why does God take us to the mat? To initiate positive change. Alone, we would never seek it. Verse 29 to 30, Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." Peniel, the Hebrew meaning of the word penim is face. He calls the place Peniel. Root word there in Hebrew, it means face, which is important because Jacob finds himself coming face to face with three different things. He's coming face to face with his past. My name is Jacob. He's come face to face with God. He's about ready to come face to face with Jacob. This place is called Peniel. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel and was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of the hip was touched near the tendon. All right, so in this story, there's an awful lot going on, and there's a progression that takes place that is taking Jacob through transformation. And if you're taking notes on your bulletin, you get to the very first thing that happens. It says that he's alone with God. He's alone with God. Because he is alone with God, he has set himself in a position to be transformed by God. But it starts with him being alone with God. And I wonder, what does your alone with God time look like? If I were to follow you around for a week, what does your "I'm just getting alone with God" time look like? What does your time of prayer look like? Your time in scripture look like? Your time just being in awe of what God is doing around you time look like? What does your alone with God time look like? I came across a prayer recently that I just loved. And this prayer says this: "Cultivate my heart, Lord, so I may catch every word that falls from heaven, every syllable of encouragement, every sentence of rebuke, every paragraph of instruction, every page of warning. Help me catch these words as the soft, fertile soil catches seeds." What a beautiful prayer. Because it's essentially what is taking place when we choose to carve out time and space to be alone with God. We're saying, "God, I just want to receive from you. I want to be more aware of who you are and what you are doing. Lord, I just want to be near you in this moment." What does your alone time with God look like? Some people use devotionals. They find them very helpful. I know a number of you use the devotional Jesus Calling. It's a great resource. There is a book that I came across a number of years ago. It was written for students, but every adult that's ever used it has come back saying, "That was great." It's called Enjoy the Silence. It's written by a couple, Maggie and Duffy Robbins. And it's a 30-day journey just soaking in scripture and prayer. I've used it multiple times. One of the ones that I use fairly regularly is one called Dear Abba. And it's just morning and evening prayers, along with some scripture and some writings. Lent is almost upon us. Lent will be starting off with Ash Wednesday, which I think is February 10th this year. It's really early. And just like last year, we're putting together a scripture reading schedule so that during the 40 days of Lent, you can just soak yourself in the scriptures. That might be a very, very helpful discipline for you going into the Lent season. Other people journal and just take time writing their prayers to God, writing their observations before the Lord. There are lots of different ways to be alone with God, and I'm not here to tell you which way is the best way. But my question is, what is your way? One of the first things we teach our children is something that as we get older, we become too busy to do ourselves. With our children, one of the first things we teach our children when they come to a street, we tell them to stop, look, and listen. This is essentially what it means to get alone with God. We are stopping what we are doing so we can look around, see the hand of God at work, and listen for the whisper of the Almighty. To live a life without spending time alone with God is to live a life dodging traffic. Stop, look, listen, just be alone with God. The transformation in Jacob's life, at least in this passage, begins with this notation that he is alone with God. But it takes us to that next moment in the story where he is broken by God. So if I were to ask you, where in the story is Jacob broken by God? Chances are we would answer when he touched his hip, which would be a correct answer, but it would be an incomplete answer. Because I believe that the true brokenness in the story takes place two verses later when he says, "My name is Jacob." It's in that moment. He's already been touched in the hip, but he's still fighting. He goes, "What's your name?" And he says, "My name is Jacob. I'm the one that has lived a life of deception. I am the one that has lived a life of self-centeredness. I am the one that has lived a life of lying and stealing and just getting what's mine. And now I find myself in a place where I'm afraid, I'm overcome, and I'm recognizing that I can't live like this anymore. My name is Jacob, and I'm broken." And I wonder, have you ever had a "my name is Jacob" moment? That moment where you say, "You know what? I have tried to live my life in such a way, thinking that that will lead me to a place of some definition of success, only to find that my life is more defined by shame and regret and guilt. And I can't live like this anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's not working. There's a part of my life that I finally admit is bankrupt. My name is Jacob." Have you come to that place ever in your life when you realize my way is not working? There's a moment in the story when he says, "My name is Jacob," that it seems as if Jacob is embracing his brokenness. And I go, who does that? We don't like feeling broken. I have broken at least 7 different bones. And I have not enjoyed any of those experiences. We don't like the feeling of being broken. About 20 years ago, there was a very popular worship song, and groups would sing it, "Holiness, holiness is what I long for. Holiness is what I need. Holiness is what you want from me." Then the second verse, "Righteousness, righteousness is what I long for. Righteousness is what I need. Righteousness is what you want from me." And it keeps going, and it gets, "Brokenness, brokenness is what I long for. Brokenness is what I," and I'm sitting there, I remember one night, I'm sitting there, all these people are singing, and they get to the brokenness part of the song, and their eyes are closed, and they're smiling, and their hands are lifted up. "Brokenness is what I long for." I'm thinking, really? What kind of nut job are you? Who wants brokenness? None of us want it, but we certainly need to embrace it. Because until we embrace our brokenness, the chances for us to be made into the people that God desires for us to be is greatly compromised. I came across something recently, and I wish I could tell you the author because it was beautifully written. But this individual said, "We think we can't use things that are broken, but God prefers not to use things until they are. He uses broken soil to give crops, broken clouds to give rain, broken eggs to give life, broken cocoons to give flight, broken grain to give bread, broken bread to give strength. It was a broken alabaster box that gave fragrant perfume to anoint the Son of God. It was the broken Son of God that brought salvation for the people of God. He makes it better and beautiful through brokenness." It's the big story of Scripture that we started talking about a couple of weeks ago. God creates a world that is good and beautiful and functional, and we choose to go and do things our own way, apart from the way God has prescribed and commanded. And as a result, that beautiful, functional, tohu of world is broken. But then God is not content to let his creation remain broken, which means he's not content to leave you broken either. He says, "Let me show you. I'm going to go to great lengths to make sure that you do not need to remain broken. I want to restore you. I want to make it tov again." Roberta Hestinus puts it this way. She says, "Brokenness is a yielded heart open before God. a heart emptied of pride and self-sufficiency. In brokenness, we discover ourselves again to be hungry and thirsty, poor and needy, when we thought ourselves to be full and needing nothing but ourselves. Along with this awareness comes a rediscovery of God's love, mercy, and forgiveness, his affirmation of us, care for us, and claim upon us. That's what brokenness is. Brokenness is finally getting to that place in our lives. We go, God, I can't do this anymore. The good news is when we cry out in our brokenness, we go, God, I can't do this anymore. I'm a mess. I've tried to fix the problems in my life using my own strength, my own intellect, my own resources, and it's left me somewhat bankrupt. But the good news is when we cry out to God, when we cry out to God, he is quick to forgive, and in the words of the Apostle Paul, he makes us a new creation. We discover when we cry out to God that God meets us with relentless tenderness. And God says, I have been waiting for you to stop singing that song. I've been waiting for you to stop singing, I'll do it my way. For I long to hear you sing the song you sang this morning, Lord, I need you. I've been waiting for you to sing the song, I surrender all. He says, when you do, I will make you new. I will restore you. I will restore our relationship. And that takes us to the third step in this transformation process we see in the life of Jacob. Name changed by God. Jacob finally acknowledges he's broken. I'm broken. My name is Jacob. And God says, you're no longer Jacob. Because you cried out to me, I'm changing your name. Your new name is Israel. You have a new name. You're a new creation. You have been forgiven. You've been set free to live into the life that I want you to live. I've spent most of my summers going to camp for at least a week, if not longer. One summer, I was working at Alliance Redwoods near Sebastopol, and I was on program staff for a week, and one of my counselors came up to me and says, Mike, I need help. I said, Rob, what's going on? What's up? And he goes, you gotta help me with Chucky. Everybody at camp knew who Chucky was. It was a camp for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, and Chucky was a mess. He was. He might be one of the most angry children I have ever met in my life. He was kind of a goofy kid. I mean, his hair was going in all different directions. He had a giant overbite. He was kind of a odd-looking kid. Add to it, his clothes didn't fit, and the clothes that he was wearing were out of date and dirty. And he had developed a defense mechanism that he was going to push everybody away so that they didn't have the chance to push him away. He was an angry, angry kid. And so Rob comes up to me and he says, Mike, I need help with Chucky. And I said, tell you what, Rob, we meet every morning and every evening in what the camp called the tabernacle, kind of the big meeting area. And I said, when we meet there, I'll sit with Chucky, because Rob really wanted to see Chucky do well, but he also realized he had 7 or 8 fourth, fifth, and sixth graders he needed to give attention to as well. So I go, I'll sit with Chucky. So every morning and every evening, I'd sit with Chucky. And we'd sit there, and I'd try to engage him, and it was just like, nope, I want nothing to do with you. Every morning, every evening, same thing. Until the last night of camp. And the speaker at this camp started talking about how when God comes into your life, when you invite him in, he changes your name. And they used that song. Some of you are probably familiar with it. I will change your name. You shall no longer be called wounded, outcast, lonely, or afraid. I will change your name. Your new name shall be confidence, joyfulness, overcoming one, faithfulness, friend of God, one who seeks my face. And then as the speaker is talking, he's talking about when you say yes to God, he changes your name. What's your new name? And everything. All of a sudden, these fourth, fifth, and sixth graders are starting to say, you know, joyfulness, you know, faithfulness. And I'm kind of sitting there, just kind of watching everything going on. I go, this is kind of cool. And then right next to me, Chucky bolts straight up and yells, I'm God's friend, and sits down. Amazing things happen when we acknowledge our brokenness before a God who loves us with relentless tenderness. Because God can take what is broken and restore it to wholeness, can restore it to beauty and function. Where are you on this transformation story? Maybe you're someone who's like, you know what, I've never really spent any kind of time with God. This is all very new to me. I love that you're here this morning. I'd encourage you, just spend some time going, God, don't know what to say, but I think being alone with you is important. Maybe you used to have the discipline of being alone with God and you've lost that, and it's time to come back to it. Or maybe you're right here, and maybe today is your I am Jacob moment where you go, I'm broken. I've tried it my way, and it has not worked. And I'm finally going to confess before God, I need you. I'm broken. If that's you, it could be as simple this morning as simply going, God, my name is Jacob. I've tried. I need you. I don't fully understand all that means, but God, I need you. The good news is that because of Jesus Christ, he hears those cries and he washes us clean and he gives us a new name. And maybe it's time this morning for you to realize or remember that he has already forgiven you and you've forgotten your new identity in him. Every morning before church, I spend some time praying down in the youth room. And as I'm getting ready to leave the youth room this morning, I'm getting ready to walk out, you know, go do my job. And I go, wait a second, what's my name? Yes, my name is Michael Frederick Stell. I realized that. But I stopped, and before God, I said, God, what's my name? And I could hear him so very clearly say, you are one that is greatly loved. And if this morning's sermon is a phenomenal sermon, I'm not going to love you any more than I already do. And if the sermon this morning is a complete train wreck, I'm not going to love you less. Your name is one that is greatly loved by me. What's yours? Would you pray with me, please?